You're listening to podcasts from the Congressional Internet Caucus Advisory Committee, www.netcaucus.org.
Congressman Gelein is obviously the co-chair of the Congressional Internet Caucus, and he's a prominent member of the House Judiciary Committee. He sits on the Subcommittee on Intellectual Property, Competition, and the Internet, which is relevant pretty much for all the topics that you may want to discuss today. He's also chairman of the Republican Technology Working Group, which was appointed by the Speaker of the House, so it's a really significant position within the Republican Party. And he also co-chairs the International Anti-Piracy Caucus. So in all those, all that work that Congress does on technology covers almost every issue, and we are thrilled to have him as our co-chair. And with that, may I introduce you to Congressman Bob Goodlatte.
Tim, thank you very much, and if it's all right with everybody, I'll just stay right here. We'll try to keep this as informal as possible, and I'll keep my remarks as brief as possible, and really I'm here to listen to your interests and your concerns and answer your questions. I'll give you in a minute a list of issues that we're working on in the Congress. I'm not going to go into the details of each one of those because I'd rather you pick out the ones you'd rather have me speak about at some greater length. But I will say that the Congressional Internet Caucus is well run by Tim Lorden, and it is one of the largest and most active caucuses of any kind in the Congress. We have a caucus for almost anything you can think of. We have a pork caucus that actually talks about pork, not legislative spending programs, and so you can just imagine. But most of them are just organizations in name only, where a member of Congress can put their name on a list and say, yeah, I'm interested in that subject, and really they never do anything. The Congressional Internet Caucus, in contrast, has well over 100 House members and senators. They have active outside support through a 501c4 organization. And they have an advisory council that runs that. So they put on programs in the Congress on a regular basis with regard to issues related to technology and the Internet. And they'll get a huge crowd. You've heard the adage from Milton Friedman, there's no such thing as a free lunch. But like here today, you give people a lunch and you seem to get a good turnout. And that's what they do with these congressional staffers, and with great success and also participation by a lot of members. So over time, the Congress, which still has a long way to go, has made a lot of progress in terms of focusing on issues related to technology. Every member of Congress represents a different kind of district, but every district is heavily dependent upon the products that you develop here in Silicon Valley and other technology centers around the country and around the world. And we need to be paying more attention to that and addressing those issues. And we've had considerable success over the years in doing that. Back in about the year 2000, Yahoo, Internet Life, named me the most Internet-friendly member of Congress. Well, I went home to tell my 14-year-old son, who today works for Facebook here in the Valley. And I said, Bobby, Yahoo just named me the most Internet-friendly member of Congress. And without missing a beat, he looked at me and said, gee, Dad, that's sad. He said, if you're the most Internet-friendly member of Congress, the Congress has a long way to go. I said, well, they're not talking about how well I use the technology. They're talking about my understanding and work on the policy issues related to the Internet. And those issues are very, very important, not only for the success of your industry in terms of the government not getting in your way and not creating things that can actually hinder the deployment and development of new technology, but really also very, very important in terms of getting our economy going again, creating jobs in the country. There's no doubt in my mind that the key to that is for businesses of all kinds, and individuals for that matter too, but really focus on businesses for a minute, to become more efficient, to be able to develop more competitive products, to bring those products to market more competitively. In order to do that, they have to utilize the technology that you deploy. And then, of course, the technology that you develop yourself is probably the fastest growing or one of the fastest growing sectors of the economy. So really what we're all about in the Congress is growing the economy, creating jobs, and trying to make government operate more efficiently. All of those are things in which you play a very vital role. So I said earlier that I would tick off some of the issues that I'm dealing with, and then that may be the best way to segue to some of the questions. I think Tim has a question to start with, and then we'll take them from the audience. But let me just throw these out. I'm not going to comment on them all, but patent reform, rogue websites, internet taxes, the Video Privacy Protection Act, cybersecurity, broadband, data retention, clean energy, and the immigration workforce-related technology issue are all things that I attempt to work on and have bills dealing with several of them, but I'm going to let you pick out the ones you're most interested in hearing about, and I'll turn it back to you, Tim.
Well, you know, as far as opening up for questions, I could have opened up the newspaper and done ripping the headlines for the issues of the day. You can talk about BART and privacy and free expression. You could talk about, you know, patents. I think that was in the newspaper today. Patents was pretty big. One thing I think would be interesting to talk about was cybersecurity. As far as, you know, the United States Congress, we're having hacks by Anonymous and LulzSec, and it doesn't seem to be any stopping it. So in your committee, you're drafting legislation. Every different committees are drafting different types of legislation. What legislation for cybersecurity is your committee drafting, and what's the prognosis for moving that with other committees and towards passage and maybe some relief from the stuff?
Right. Well, as you indicated earlier, I serve on the Judiciary Committee. In fact, I'm chairman of the Intellectual Property Competition and the Internet Subcommittee. This actually is the jurisdiction of another subcommittee, but it's one that I have a keen interest in. I have always been very supportive of efforts in the Congress to promote cybersecurity, and I've done it in ways that the government, by that I mean the executive branch of the government, doesn't always see as the best way to go about doing it. Back in the 1990s, I pushed legislation to deal with encryption. The federal government in those days thought that only the CIA and the NSA and the FBI should be able to control encryption tools. And basically, while they didn't have any legal authority for limiting the strength of the encryption that you attached to the hardware and software products that you developed and sold, they could limit the strength of that encryption on products that you exported. And my attitude was that you might as well put a stamp on the box. In those days, most software came out in big boxes, make it look like you're getting a really good deal on what you bought. And you might as well put a stamp on the box that says the federal government has a key to this piece of software that you're buying for whatever purpose. And that stemmed from their long-term attitude that in order to protect society, governments needed to control the means of encrypting communications, and if you let other people have it, then the spies and the criminals and the terrorists and so on would have it. Well, the fact of the matter is, big drug kingpins in South America, they had their own engineers developing their own encryption technology and keys, and it was the legitimate business person, legitimate individual who wanted to have protection that was being denied it. And we were, at the same time, creating the growth of technology industries in countries around the world. Probably a dozen or more countries got a good leg up on developing all kinds of software products by being able to say, we have unlimited encryption protecting this software. And you can just look around the world and see what countries have gotten and maintained that advantage, all at our expense. So we worked in a bipartisan fashion. Zoe Lofgren was the chief Democratic co-sponsor of my bill. We signed up over 250 members of Congress to co-sponsor it. And basically what the legislation did was it prohibited the federal government from limiting the strength of encryption on exports and banned them from getting a backdoor key to your computer programs. The legislation never actually was passed into law, because at that time, the late 1990s, Al Gore was getting ready to run for president, and the inventor of the internet could not be on the wrong side of the issue. So the Clinton administration did a complete 180 changed their position. And while we have to periodically go back and look at this again from time to time, that was, in my opinion, the best step we've ever taken forward in empowering a great industry to take a lead in solving cybersecurity issues. Now we have a wide array of problems related to cybersecurity, everything from cyber warfare with major countries, you know, people named China as one to be aware of, but it could come from anywhere, right down to the issue of how does one protect oneself from identity theft and other things that are very personal attacks on individuals, all under the rubric of cybersecurity. So we've set up a task force in the Congress, Speaker Boehner did, not to write one big massive piece of legislation, but to use as a clearinghouse to gather information and then sort of make recommendations to various committees about issues that they could deal with. And really, there's a dozen different committees in Congress that can make a contribution here. But I think the best contributions come from, again, freeing up your industry to solve the problem. So to get finally around to Tim's question, what I'm now working on is legislation that promotes the development of cybersecurity by giving your industry limited liability reforms. In other words, if you are going to stick your neck out and attempt to offer a new product to deal with some aspect of cybersecurity, we ought not make you the target of, you see the ads on TV for the drug companies. You know, you put a drug on the market and something doesn't quite go right, then you see a long series of ads from lawyers who say, okay, if you took this drug, if you had this experience, whatever, call us, call this 800 number and we'll take your case. We don't want that to happen. We actually had a trial run of this type of legislation a decade ago with the Y2K issue that I know many of you recall. We passed legislation in the Congress that said if you stick your neck out and help solve the Y2K problem, we will give you some limited liability protection. Not no liability, because that would work the opposite effect. Then that would say to people, you don't have to worry about this issue at all, whether or not you're liable, but limiting your exposure so that you can make a decision in your company to say, yes, we're going to offer products in this area, and know that we can make a contribution without being totally exposed if a product proves to be not as effective as we expect it will be. So we're working on that legislation in Congress right now.
Once again, thank you so much for coming and joining us here. It's a real treat for us to have the opportunity to discuss issues with you. My guess is that this is a relatively hostile audience on the topic of the Protect IP Act. Let's just get that on the table. So I'll ask you the comparative softball question on that topic, and I'm guessing you might get some harder-hitting questions from the audience. But I'm curious what you think we've learned from the Department of Homeland Security's efforts to seize domain names for sites that they've deemed rogue, and how you think that the legislation responds to some of the criticisms of those seizures.
Okay, well, the Protect IP Act, for those of you who are maybe not following it as closely as some, is the Senate version of dealing with an issue that's popularly referred to in the Congress as the rogue websites issue, and that being websites that are set up and maybe for the sole purpose of selling intellectual property that does not belong to them. It may be for a completely different purpose, and incident to that purpose may find that others are utilizing the website to sell any kind of product. It doesn't have to be a digital product. Doesn't have to be music or movies or software or video games. It could be a website that is selling Vibram shoes, you know, the shoes with the toes in them. We had a hearing on this issue, and we had a witness head of that company came in and brought the counterfeit shoe and the real shoe, and you can't tell them apart. In fact, they're both manufactured in China. But the fact of the matter is that the website on which they're sold today, and this has basically changed very dramatically in the last decade, is enabling people in China to manufacture a product that is a counterfeit good and sell it through a website and then ship that tangible good in the United States in individual packages, which Customs Service, which historically has a job of finding that big freight container full of counterfeit goods and seizing it, making sure it doesn't get into the U.S. market. Well, when they're coming in individual packets directly to consumers, you can't do that anymore. So the focus has shifted to the websites, and under what circumstances can various types of actions be taken to address that? Well, the Senate bill has been criticized in a number of areas, and some, I think, rightfully so. I think in answer to your question, I would say that I wouldn't say under no circumstances could they do it, but they could do a better job of it, and perhaps with better guidelines for doing it. So we're working in response to the Senate bill and in response to the demand from wide sectors of industry, driven primarily by the entertainment industry, but, you know, movies and music and so on, but certainly other sectors of our economy as well. We are working on legislation to try to address this and address it in a way that is more sensitive to individuals' First Amendment freedoms, more sensitive to the needs of law-abiding businesses that might be financial services companies, that might be search engines, that might be advertisers that are unwittingly advertising on a site that is selling stolen goods, if you will. But in any event, to make sure that whatever we ask of them in this effort to combat this multi-billion dollar problem is one that is reasonable, that does not interfere with their ability to offer their legitimate services on the Internet, and you can expect a House version of the bill, which will be quite different. I wouldn't want to offer that there won't be criticism from the tech community, but I would offer there probably also be criticism from some on the other side who'd like to see some things that are in the Senate bill that will be different in this bill. You can expect to see that, I would think, within the next few weeks, and we hope to hold a hearing on the legislation in the middle of September. It's an important issue. It's an issue that needs to be addressed, but it needs to be addressed creatively, and it needs to be a work in progress. Once we put our cards on the table, if you will, we should expect to hear and respond to criticism, which we already have been doing in terms of criticism to the Senate bill, to see if we can't get both the tech community and the purveyor of various types of products are working together, because you really need each other. If you have an internet marketplace that is rife with various types of criminal activities and so on, that is not as conducive to growth of the technology as it is to offer those great technologies and services offered by legitimate companies and find ways to help protect those products so that the actual creator of the product is rewarded for their work.
So let me just do a little Donahue thing here and open up the Q&A.
Thanks, Congressman. So on the issue of Protect IP, I'm Michael Barclay. I'm a volunteer at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, just to let you know where I'm coming from. On the issue of the Protect IP Act, is your House committee, does it have a technical paper published by five Internet security consultants back in May, as well as a letter from 100 IP professors, one of whom was Eric Olden, who's sitting next to you, pointing out some serious problems with the Senate bill as drafted. And I have copies here that I can bring to you now or at the end of this if you need them.
I have a feeling we do, but since I can't say with certainty, we'd be happy to have the benefit of both of those papers. And I will make sure that the committee staff and my staff who are working with me on this have the benefit of them as well.
The technical paper in particular points out how the Senate bill will actually break the domain name system in a way that will cause harm to network security on the Internet. And I have not seen any response from the entertainment industry as to why that supposedly is wrong. which I'd certainly like to see before any bill is passed.
Sure. Well, I'm sure that that will be the subject of the next. We've had several hearings on this, but we haven't had a hearing on the legislation because the legislation hasn't been finalized yet. But we will do that, as I say, soon, and those kind of questions are very legitimate and should be addressed.
Betty Caden, I'm a CFO for startups, and my question is, we've got a budget problem. Why aren't we legalizing internet gambling? Tax the heck out of it, solves a lot of problems. People are going to do it anyway. It's like prohibition. So how do you guys feel about internet gambling?
Well, it may be well known that I am the author of the internet gambling legislation from the Judiciary Committee, which got left on the cutting room floor, which would have modernized the Wire Act to make clear what is legal and what is illegal. But I think the issue here is this. In the United States, gambling is illegal unless regulated by the states. And if you guys develop the technology that allows a state to assure that the participants in the internet gambling are within the confines of that state, and that there are no minors participating, then there's nothing to stop any state from doing that. The District of Columbia believes that they can do that right now, and they may be the closest to any governmental entity that I'm aware of, although there's several states looking at as well who want to do that. Personally, I'm not a fan of gambling, and I think gambling on the internet is, you know, particularly some of the technologies that are used there. Playing poker on the internet just seems absolutely ludicrous to me. That you don't know, and we've had a number of instances of this. You don't know who's seeing whose cards and who's at the virtual table with you, if you will. But as long as it's regulated by the states, I have no problem with that. I have no interest whatsoever in having the federal government get into having a federal gaming commission. But more importantly, I know that overwhelmingly the states have no interest in having the federal government getting into a federal gaming commission and competing with them for those tax revenues that you have correctly noted is the case. And every state takes a different approach to this than every other. Some states, like Utah, have virtually no legal gambling within the state. I'm not talking about internet gambling of any kind. Right next door in Nevada, you have virtually every type of gambling available. And I believe that that's really the way it ought to stay. I think government that is closer to the people works better. And I also recognize that if somebody is absolutely dedicated to wanting to participate in an offshore gambling site and wants to find a way to route the money there, they certainly will find a way to do it. But I also don't think that it is a particularly good thing for government to be promoting. It's not the way for most people to grow their own personal wealth, much less that of the economy of the country. And we've had a lot of cooperation from the financial services industry, not all of it always voluntarily, but it has cut down on the amount of this type of activity that is taking place in the United States. There's lots of problems with gambling of any kind, and I won't take you through all of the reasons for that. All I will say is that the legislation does not ban internet gambling. It simply keeps the federal government out of it and gives a new enforcement tool to the states. A lady sitting a couple of seats behind you, who formerly headed eBay and PayPal. PayPal took a real lead in not wanting to get tangled up in handling payments for internet gambling before this law was even adopted and put into place, and I commend her for that.
That's right. We've got it right here.
I'm speaking of Meg Whitman, by the way, of course.
Congressman. I'm for a simple Silicon Valley Bank. We provide banking for a lot of startups and entrepreneurial companies here and around the world. But and by the way, I also worked for a Judiciary Committee with Lamar Smith, when he was a more junior member. But my question, you ran through a list of issues that you're looking at now. There's a perception out here that very, very little is going to come out of this Congress, come out of the Senate, be passed into law by the President. On those lists of six or seven things that you mentioned, Did you tell me anything
ten.
That you're confident will really get dealt with first?
Ten. There's ten items here.
How many of those do you think will make it through the process and actually result in some kind of legislative change?
Well, the first one on the list I think will. That's patent reform. We've been working for 10 years to get patent reform done. The Senate passed a bill. It was not well received here generally in the tech community, although some like it better than others. The House passed a bill that is liked better here, but doesn't go as far as I would like it to go. But you have to deal with the reality that it has to pass the House, pass the Senate, get signed into law. So we wrote a different bill. It strengthens patent protection for those who are utilizing licensing patents in terms of making it easier to challenge somebody who has maybe a patent troll and has a patent but perhaps shouldn't. It gives a greater opportunity for a company here in the Valley that's putting together a product that has 400 or 500 or more patents involved in that product to be able to go in while a patent application is pending and show that there's prior art and get kicked out. It strengthens the ability to challenge what are called business method patents in certain areas. It strengthens the ability to challenge a patent after it's been issued, and it gives the patent office more resources to do a better job. What we want to do here is we want to grant patents more quickly, and we want to improve the quality of the patents so that they are truly new ideas and not just a retreaded idea or not just something that can be kept below the surface until somebody who really is putting money into developing a new product puts their product on the market and then they come in and say, well, you stole my patent idea. The courts have also been moving in what I think is the right direction in this area in damages and venue. I think that's one where the Senate will wind up taking the bill and passing it. Hopefully, as soon as we go back in September, Senator Reid has already put that in motion. I think that legislation dealing with internet taxes, I'm not talking about the streamlined sales tax legislation. I think that has a long way to go. But legislation giving companies, whether they're primarily doing business online or whether they're primarily doing business offline, but better guidance if they want to do business in another state, they want to know whether they're going to be subject to corporate income taxes, subject to business activity taxes, and so on in another state. That legislation, I think, has got very strong bipartisan support, has passed out of the Judiciary Committee. We'll bring that to the floor. I think that has a good chance as well. Of these bills, I would say almost all of them will see legislation coming out of the House. And the real test will be, can you get it through the Senate? The Senate is a body that some of us say has no rules, but it actually does have rules, but those rules work in a fashion that makes the Senate less functional, some would say dysfunctional. And the two primary ones are the filibuster, the unlimited debate, if you will, and the lack of germaneness rules, so you can attach unrelated things to a bill. So if you get a good small idea, can you get that idea to go all the way through? I see lots of state legislatures where they'll vote on far more bills than we voted on in the House of Representatives in any given year, but they take a smaller idea and they keep it a small idea and they pass that all the way through and it gets to the governor's desk and gets signed. We ought to be focused on trying to do more of that. And unfortunately, primarily because of Senate rules, that doesn't happen. People say, well, I want to attach this to this bill, I want to attach that, and if you don't, I'm going to filibuster and I'm going to slow the whole thing down. That's got to be addressed by the Senate at some point in time, or the legislative branch as a whole, not just the Senate, but the House as well, will be ceding more and more power to the executive branch. You see it already in efforts to take old laws that were passed and reinterpret the regulations to expand the power of the unelected bureaucracy at the expense of the Congress. And one of the things that drives that is the inability of the Congress to pass bills. It's not just this Congress in this particular environment. It's all recent Congresses not having the ability to push legislation all the way through to the President's desk.
Hello, I'm Mark
Rauscher,
the Auto Channel. And you ticked off one of the items was broadband, and so I'm hoping that that has to do with availability, access to broadband, and having been a victim in the late 80s, early 90s of getting shut out of the cable television industry, we are very concerned that we don't get gatekeeper out of the internet. And so so if this is indeed what you're referring to, I would like you to talk about what maybe you're doing to keep it open and free. And then I have a second part sort of that question, which is, have you started or has anybody thought to inquire as to what Google did with the Pandora algorithm updates, whether that begins to affect gatekeeping, and have you looked at that to see if they're doing something improper?
I have, on the second part of your question first, no, I have not, and if you have some information you'd like to pass along to me, I'd be happy to pass it on to the committee. Remember, the committee, the subcommittee that I chair is interesting. For the first time ever, intellectual property issues have been combined with antitrust issues. And this it's an interesting combination because if you think about it, what a patent is a granting of a monopoly to an individual who's created something to exploit that creation for a limited period of time. And that's protected by our Constitution. But antitrust laws are designed to break up the monopolization of the manufacture of a product or the provision of a service by a company. And so bringing them together, it creates kind of a synergy that allows us to look at issues like this. So broadband actually covers a wider spectrum of, you know, how do you get it deployed to reach inner cities and rural areas and make sure that we are in a very large country with a large and diverse population, trying to keep up with smaller countries that can more precisely target how they bring faster speeds online. But your question relates more to what's now called net neutrality. And I introduced a bill along with Congressman Rick Boucher. We were the co-chairs of the Internet Caucus until he was defeated last year. And about a decade ago, we introduced a bill. We didn't call it net neutrality. We called it open access. And what it was an effort to take the antitrust laws and modify them to make sure that they were more usable by small businesses, because sometimes antitrust can be a very, it's a good tool, but it can be a very expensive tool to use. And to basically say that the companies delivering access to the internet to people's homes and all of the businesses that are taking place on that, the ability for people in those homes to reach and businesses to reach all those businesses should be kept open, and that it was an antitrust violation to do otherwise. We had an interesting coalition of support that included America Online until they thought they were acquiring Time Warner. It turned out Time Warner was acquiring them, but it included the telephone companies, but not the cable companies, because the telephone companies were regulated and the cable companies were not. And all of that evolved and changed over time. And the advocates for that transformed themselves into a lot of internet-based companies that didn't own pipes, but owned products and services that were offered on the pipes, and worried about companies that were vertically integrating, where they were owning the content and the technology, shutting out their competition from being able to get access to the internet. That, to me, is every bit as much an antitrust violation, and so we're working on legislation to deal with that. Now, at the same time, there's been litigation related to some FCC efforts in this area, and there has been legislation coming from a different perspective that relates to government regulation in this area, and that having failed in the last Congress, the FCC said, and this goes right back to this gentleman's question over here about, you know, where is legislation going and where is the regulatory agencies going? Well, the FCC said, well, they didn't pass legislation, but we can do it regulatorily. I don't think they can. I don't think they have the authority to do it under law, and that's also being challenged in the courts, and we'll find out the answer to that in the near future. But I also hope they can't do it, not because I'm not against the concept they're trying to promote, but because I think government regulation of this, as opposed to government policies that says you can throw the book at the bad guys, but the good guys, they've got to go out and compete in the rough and tumble world of the internet. That is the better approach, because if you get what you wish for here, which is the government stepping in and saying, we're going to write the rules of the road for this part of how business is conducted on the internet, that will be just the beginning of the government writing the rules of the road for a whole host of different areas where you have free and open competition today on the internet. And I think that's the wrong way to go.
If I could just add that.
Sure.
I think that the FCC was part and parcel of the problem in the cable television industry, and that they actually created and allowed the gatekeeper in the way that the FCC does that, by claiming that they're opening it up more, but they don't. If you're not a member of the club, you can't get in. So the FCC making a regulation.
It worries me very much when you ask bureaucrats to pick winners and losers in any sector of our economy. The internet has grown, in my opinion, because of the really unfettered access of people with all kinds of ideas to the internet. We don't want them to lose that access, but I don't want the federal government to be writing tight rules of the road. I want instead the federal government to be saying, these are the parameters. If you combine to exclude somebody access to the internet, particularly if they're a competitor of yours, that's a violation of the law, and you can be held accountable for that. And I think that's, in my opinion, the preferred way to go. The FCC has acted. They have implemented their plan, and they have been challenged in court. They've been struck down once, and they're now being challenged again. I think they'll be struck down again, but I don't know that for a fact. Stay tuned.
Before I go to the next question, I just wanted to note that this conversation, you can follow it on Twitter at the hashtag #POUNDSOTN. So,
thanks. Hi, Larry Downs of Tech Freedom. Nice to see you, Congressman, and Tim as well. Thank you for coming to our side of the continent. We really appreciate it. I think for many people in Silicon Valley, one of the biggest issues requiring government intervention has to do with spectrum reform. There is multiple bills that have been circulated this last term, giving the FCC new authority to conduct voluntary incentive auctions, also to free up some underutilized or unused government spectrum. They don't seem to be moving. They were part of the budget negotiation as well, maybe part of the super committee. I guess my question, Congressman, what do you think is holding up the decision of Congress to move forward with this authority? And secondly, is there anything that we in Silicon Valley can do to help get this done before the mobile internet comes to a grinding halt?
Well, I think that you need to speak up and you need to be very loud about it, because there's absolutely no question that certain users of spectrum are running short of what they need. Obviously, you can this community as a whole can help, as you already have helped, by figuring out ways to use it more and more efficiently, because that's certainly going to play a part in this. Whatever portion of the spectrum you get as much out of it as you possibly can. But here again, the issue comes back, in my opinion, to sectors that use that spectrum and use it very, very inefficiently. Unfortunately, some of the ones that use it the most inefficiently are very important users, like defense and intelligence and emergency services and so on, that have significant chunks of spectrum that need to use it more efficiently, because that is not as big a growth area as individual and business use of mobile communications, and therefore they need to give up some of their spectrum for that purpose, but getting to do it is difficult. I would suspect, although I'm not on the committees that have jurisdiction over this, that money plays a role in this as well. Unlike some of the other things we've talked about with the internet, spectrum is public property. It does belong to all the people, and the issue of how you allocate it definitely gets tangled up with how much money can the government get for reallocating it, and that's certainly a part of this discussion debate as well.
My name is Dennis Fernandez. I'm a Silicon Valley patent attorney and venture capitalist. I'm responding to your comment regarding the Patent Reform Act, and I just wanted to share a Silicon Valley perspective from the little guys, you know, the entrepreneurs and researchers at universities. I think there's a consistent fear that the Patent Reform Act from the Senate and your version will chill innovation and discourage the flow of risk capital into this fragile community, especially in the context of, you know, economic downturn. And specifically what we're worried about is any attempt by Congress to weaken U.S. patents in a global context of competition in emerging industries will discourage venture capital, and we're afraid, and I speak with a lot of inventors and startups, you know, a lot of foreign national PhDs at Stanford and Santa Clara and Berkeley, and they're afraid that your group, you know, senators and representatives are listening too much to the big constituents from Silicon Valley who have a different agenda. You know, they're the ones getting sued by the so-called trolls or, you know, the smaller guys. The little guys don't have a strong lobbying presence in your community. And you really have to find a way to listen to them because they need very strong patents to get funded, to launch companies. It's a harsh Darwinian environment to form startups these days. And what you're doing will have a very negative impact on the founding of startups in the future. And I think you're not paying attention to that. Companies like Microsoft don't need strong patent protection. And I'm afraid you're listening to their lobbying money.
Well, I appreciate your comments and your concerns. Every member of Congress has a lot of inventors in their congressional districts. And we have listened to them. And there are a wide array of points of view about this. But I do not believe that this is going to have the impact that you say. In fact, I think improving the quality of patents is going to help grow our economy, not harm it. And so no inventor of any idea should fear having a fair patent system that allows for review to assure that the ideas that they come up with are indeed new ideas that are deserving of being protected. Because the way the patent system works is we want the person who comes up with an idea to be rewarded for that idea and to be able to exploit that in the market, and that's why we give them the protection. But at the very same time, we want the next guy in this harsh Darwinian world that you describe to be working Saturday night and Sunday on the next idea that is better than the one that you just came up with, and we want it on the market tomorrow, not 20 years from now. So we want to create a situation in which there is the maximum amount of competition, but also the maximum quality to assure that that first guy does indeed have a valid patent. And the mechanisms that are in here to assure that, I think, are fair. Some concern has been expressed by the U.S. moving from a first-to-invent to a first-to-file system. And I think it's very important that every inventor understand, and I think most do by now because we've really been going through this a long time, first to file does not mean that somebody can find out that an inventor developed something and say, well, I'm going to be the first in to file it. All it means is the first inventor to file. And in this competitive environment, you know, as do a lot of other people here in this valley and elsewhere around the country and around the world, what the cutting edge places you're looking, you know, the person who's trying to develop a more efficient solar fuel cell. There are a lot of people out there working on that, and if two people come up with the same idea at the same time from completely disparate sources, that is something that does not happen infrequently. It happens fairly often. And when you do, you need to have a much better tool for determining who wins under those circumstances. And studies that I've seen, and I'll be happy to share those, if you give me your card, I'll send you those, show that small inventors benefit from the first-to-file system because they are more fleet of foot. They are more flexible. They do react more quickly than the bulky, large corporations that, yes, they have a lot of patents, but they don't always know exactly what to do with a lot of them. So in terms of who's going to be the first to file and who will be able to exploit it, I think that system will work better for you, not worse. Am I an expert on this subject? No. And I respect and understand your fear when you refer to those guys in the Senate and those guys in the House. But unfortunately, we are the ones charged with reviewing what our Constitution charges us with and updating those laws. And there hasn't been an update in our patent laws in more than 50 years. And there's a lot of evidence to support that the United States is falling behind many other places in the world because our patent laws are out of date and because our patent system isn't producing good quality patents and isn't producing them quickly enough. We have a backlog of more than 1 million patents. So that's the challenge, and we've tried to hit it right. I won't claim to be perfect in my knowledge of patents or in my ability to foresee what will happen, but I think we have created a better environment for you, not a worse one, but time will tell. Let's get somebody who hasn't asked a question yet.
Congressman, it's good to see you, and thank you for coming out. I was in D.C. attorney for CBT when the Oxley Madden Amendment to the SAFE Act was defeated in Congress, so it's good to see you again. My question regarding my name is Henry O. I work for a mobile game app development company. My concern is privacy. You talk about age verification before in the context of gambling, but as we know, a lot of mobile phones and their games and apps are being used by minors. Representative Bart McMarkey introduced an amendment to COPPA, and as the game industry is in general, we're undergoing the shift to a freemium model where we don't, distribute CDs or cartridges for the games anymore. It's downloaded. We don't have a way of verifying it's on the phone.
Okay.
How can we deal with this? As game developers, we're trying to figure out what's the right model. We want to do the right thing. We want to protect privacy and information for our users, gamers, whether they're young or old. And is there anything, something like limited liability that would be in the works for something like this, where if we took certain steps, we could say that, we tried to do our best to make sure someone was over 13, rather than just, upshifting liability to Facebook Connect or something like this. So what are your thoughts?
Well, as you probably know, in the United States, privacy laws as they exist today are pretty open, with the exception of three areas where the Congress has specifically legislated. One is financial information, another is health information, and the third is information about minors. And that may be where you're focused on, since I would imagine that a good percentage of your customers or some of the products you offer are indeed minors. I would be interested in knowing whether there are modifications that could be done in that area. My basic attitude is that putting those three things aside, I'm an opt-out kind of person. I believe that the information superhighway means what it says it is, and that is an abundance of information available to people and about people, and that if you have the ability to get off the highway with regard to certain information you have, that's sufficient for me. To feel like people are being protected. In fact, I have one of these bills I mentioned here that deals with the Video Privacy Protection Act. I'd like to change that law so that if somebody is using Netflix or some service that provides music videos or some other type of video, and they want to automatically tell Netflix to automatically put whatever movies they watch up on Facebook or some other social network, great. If you want to do that, you should be able to do that. But that does intersect with what can minors do, and maybe we will have to review those protections for minors, but I think you're going to find the public is very sensitive to exploiting information about minors, and generally speaking, my kids are grown up now, and they're not nearly as focused on privacy as people of my generation are, in terms of being concerned about what other people know about them. But still, if you're underage, your parents, I think, have a right to be concerned, have protection. But if there's something reasonable that can be done to tweak that, we would welcome suggestions on that.
Congressman, apropos of that,
My understanding is that Congressman Eshoo wants to discuss, in part, kids' privacy on September 27th. So, as part of this series.
Very good. I want to tune in on Twitter on that.
Hi, I'm Joyce Cutler with BNA, and I have a question for you about your business activity and tax implications. Where do you see it going, and where do you see it aligning with places like California, the state's trying to reach out for money from hopefully deep pockets?
Well, I think, for those of you who are not familiar with this legislation, I mentioned it briefly earlier, basically what its purpose is to try to promote the expansion of small businesses by giving them clear guidance when they expand their business into another state. What kind of taxes will they be subject to in that state? And how much activity can they conduct in a state without being subject to being required to file a corporate income tax return, a business activity tax return? States are struggling to find more revenues. All states are doing that, but the smarter ones are trying to grow businesses in their state and encourage them to expand those businesses to become larger and deal in more states. At the same time, states are finding more and more ways to find a nexus with their state that is de minimis. The state of New Jersey says if you drive 7 tractor trailers through the state, that is sufficient, and you know how to get to the Northeast from a lot of other parts of the country, drive through New Jersey. You drive 7 tractor trailers through New Jersey, you've got to start filing corporate income tax returns, business activity tax returns, and that's a problem. Some states say that if you have a website on a server in a state, that's sufficient nexus with the state to have to file. There are states who have talked about it, I don't know if any have done it, that if your logo appears in the state, that's sufficient nexus with the state. Well, the Supreme Court has said that a state cannot reach out and make somebody else in another state doing business in another state tax them. This also plays into the sales tax issue. Well, that's a separate issue. Here, the Supreme Court has never defined what that nexus is, and this bill proposes to do that. And it has strong support across the board from the business community, not just people that are primarily doing business online, but people who are primarily shipping goods by tractor trailers and all the other de minimis tests that states have imposed. This would give one clear, consistent test. And the Congress has clear authority to do this because this is clearly interstate commerce, which the Congress has the authority to regulate under the Commerce Clause. Now, this gives really nervous jitters to some states, particularly states that have spent a lot of their effort trying to find the smallest contact with the state as a basis for sucking a company in from another state and taxing them. But I would argue that the states waste tremendous resources, just like the businesses do, trying to get legitimate companies to dance on the head of a pin with a small de minimis contact with the state. They would be more suited, in my opinion, to generating more revenue for their state if they focused instead on having a clear, bright line test of what every state could do with regard to outside a business being conducted in every other state, and then grow the businesses in their state by encouraging them to expand elsewhere, knowing what that bright line test is, and then taxing those businesses in their state like they tax every other citizen of the state. And so that's the answer. It's a real collision between some state governors, not all, but some certainly, and the business community. This is strongly supported by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and National Association of Manufacturers and a lot of other trade associations as well, who think that we need to give a business a clear signal on when they'll be subject to taxation and when they won't, and then let them all go at it no matter what state they're in. And I think, quite frankly, this is a small microcosm of the overall problem we're having in our economy of the government not giving clear signals to business in a whole host of different regulatory areas that is causing businesses to say, hey, I don't know what I'm getting into if I expand my business right now. And I think it plays a role in the problems around the economy. The bill has passed out of the Judiciary Committee. I believe it will come to the floor of the House. The lead Democratic co-sponsor is Congressman Bobby Scott, who's a political views on a lot of issues are very different than mine, but we are together, as are a lot of other Democrats, so I think it has a lot of momentum, and it's one on this list that I think has a better chance of making it across the finish line than some others. But we do have to work on people to work on their state governors to take a different point of view about how they raise revenue for their state. It's not always to find the smallest amount of revenue you can find from the most remote out-of-state business. It's more, how do you grow your economy in your state and generate revenues by doing so?
We'll take one more question. Yeah.
Hi, my name is Worth Yon, and I'm general counsel of a technology startup called BitTorrent. But my question is not actually on behalf of my company, but just as a member of the public. I think most of us agree on the importance of copyright protection and support copyright laws, but there's some perception and concern that a lot of copyright laws are really shaped by and influenced by copyright lobbyists who represent certain special interests. So I was wondering what you do and what you can do to ensure that the public interest in technology innovation is given due weight.
Well, certainly, you have to draw a distinction between the development of a technology like BitTorrent that can be used for excellent purposes to share all kinds of legitimate information that either isn't even copyrightable to begin with or is being shared by the people who own it and want it shared in that fashion, and the people who take the technology and create business models around stealing other people's products and utilizing that. And we do, as members of Congress, have an obligation to make sure that not only are the private property rights of people who create, great movies and music or shoes with toes in them or whatever the great idea might be, but also, the right of people to be able to access information that is free on the internet, that is, the copyright's expired or whatever the case might be, and utilize technology for those purposes. So it's a challenge to try to draw that line between the great technology that can be abused and the abuser. And that's what we're trying to do with our legislation. I'm sure we won't get it all right. I'm sure I'll hear from somebody in this room, and maybe a lot of you in this room, when you see the legislation. But we do think we have listened to the concerns about the Senate bill and taken it several steps further in terms of trying to refine the legislation and do some of the things better or not do some of the things at all. And in some areas, we're going to do some things that aren't in the Senate bill. And, hey, we don't know what you think of those yet, so you may not like those either. But we are very cognizant of the fact that there is not only private property out there, but that there are consumers who are using good products for good purposes.
I want to thank Representative Goodlatte for sharing his time with us today. He didn't set any limits on the topics that we would cover, and so it appeared that it was fair game to cover a wide range of topics, and I thought his expertise was really remarkable in covering that. So thank you again for taking the time to come today. And just a reminder that this is the first of what we hope will be five different events in this vein. You have the instructions on the back of when we are going to have them, and the URL at the bottom will be a source of additional information, so we hope you can join us there. Once again, thank you to Cooley LLP for helping us get this event and for you for coming today. Thank you.